And welcome back to the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. Now, we're joined on the line by John, who was on holiday in the south of England over Easter. One of the highlights of the holiday was going to be a trip to see Southampton in St. Mary's Park, unless I'm very much mistaken, but things didn't pan out the way John and the family wanted them to. John, good morning. John, a bad experience for the family. Tell us what happened.
It was disappointing. John, what happened was we had a family holiday, but it was actually booked 3 years ago and it was cancelled through COVID, so it was back on this Easter. So we headed off last Tuesday and just back in Belfast at the airport now as we speak. We were away for a week and we had a great time. But a couple of weeks, maybe 5 or 6 weeks ago, we said, God, we'll see if we can get a match in when we're over there, because we were closer to Bournemouth than Southampton. So we looked at Bournemouth, but they were playing away that weekend. But Southampton were at home, and they happened to be at home to Man City, which we thought, oh, great, you know, we'll see all the stars of the Man City team. I'm actually a Man United fan, and the son's a Man United fan. One of them says he's a Man City fan, but he's only 5 years of age.
Your five-year-old was wearing a Man City jersey earlier and had taken a photograph, but was then refused admittance to the ground, even though the actual jersey at that point had been covered up.
That's right. As I said, we got up to Southampton earlier on in the afternoon. The game wasn't at 5:30, so we were a couple of hours around Southampton shopping and the Lego store, and the boys were happy, and loads of Man City fans walking around, loads of Southampton fans walking around, great atmosphere, no sign of trouble. Just a normal Saturday, lovely weather. As I say, we walked out of the stadium, maybe a mile from the city centre, Man City fans walking down, Southampton fans walking down. Got outside St Mary's anyway, my wife decided she wanted to take a picture of the boys, so she got the youngest boy, the 9-year-old, to take off his hoodie, you know, when he had the Man City jersey, we took a photograph, no problem then. One of the stewards came over and asked to see her tickets. And she said, you're on the home end. And we said, yeah. And she says, well, you know, you can't be wearing... Well, we said, we know that. And, like, in fairness, I'm not that naive to walk into, the home section with a Man City jersey. We were going to cover them up, and we covered them up. But by the time we walked around to our entrance into the exit, I could see another security lady outside, and she was eyeing us up as we walked up to the... up the turnstile, Donald, and she just came over and says, can I see your tickets? And she's seen the tickets. She said, you've been spotted on camera. That was it. And we pleaded with her and tried our best, but no, she said, club policy, that's it. And I said, God, you know, we're not Man City fans. The 5-year-old has a Man City jersey on him. It's covered up now. He's a hoodie on. He's a coat over the top of it. We're going to go in. I've warned them, you know, to behave themselves and not to be shouting and going for Man City, because you don't do that. But
yeah,
no, there's no good, Donald. That was it. No one. And the boys, there were tears everywhere. Big disappointment. But, you know, as I was chatting to Caroline earlier, I had a tweet up about it afterwards and the photograph of us. But I didn't get much sympathy on Twitter, I can tell you that anyway, Donald, because it seems to be it's just not the done thing to do in English football grounds.
Yeah,
even
it's,
to have it covered up.
You see, I can see, I can kind of understand the policy. Now, you get to the point where you say, yeah, it's a policy, because if they think there is any risk that someone is going to expose an opposing jersey in the other side's end, and we know what problems they've had in English soccer over the years, thankfully, not an awful lot of it in recent years, but we all know the history. Now, and I suppose they have to say policy is policy. Your story, certainly no one is going to accuse a 5-year-old of stirring up trouble. But then again, I suppose, is the question going to be, is a 5-year-old innocently going to act like a 5-year-old and pull up the hoodie or shout something? If I recall, the scoreline did go very much in Man City's favour, if I recall the score correctly.
I said it was 4-1.
Yeah,
right?
That's what I thought. I was just trying to remember
the
match
of the
day.
Maybe, we were naive even to take the photograph outside the stadium. I think if we had a stay covered up, no one would have seen us.
Yeah.
And we would have got in okay. We would have watched the match and everything. But it's maybe just a lesson, you know.
Was there any...
I'm a more of a GA man.
Yeah, and people will probably recognise you, John, as we speak. John, in terms of, was there even any... Look, we'll take the jersey off and put it into a bag or something, or, you know, we'll just make sure he's not actually wearing it going in. Was that offered as a
We were identified, the whole lot of us, as Man City fans. Yeah. Once we've seen him with the Man City jersey outside at the far side of the stadium before we went even around to get in. So that was it. No, we were spotted. When the lady came up to us, in fairness, the security lady, the steward. But by the time we got around to the church side where we were dented, now the others said, you've been spotted on camera, you're Man City fans, you're not getting into the home end, and that's it. And I said, listen, we're here on holidays, we're from Ireland. Couldn't give a damn who was the match.
Yeah.
So if we get into it, we're tourists. All right, the young fella definitely had a Man City, but it was covered up at that stage, yeah. So no one would have seen it.
And there was no chance of getting tickets for the away end. I suppose they don't sell tickets for the away end actually at the stadium. They're all done through the other team.
There's no chance of that there at that stage. Now, in fairness, there is a Damien Doherty from Letterkenny. He's over in Southampton a long time, and Damien's he's a season ticket holder there, and he might have he's good connections. And I rang Damien straight away. This was about 5:10, and he was away on holidays at the time. But he made a few phone calls, and he rang me back maybe, it's well into the first half, and said that he had got two tickets at that stage for me. We were in the car, we were on the way back to the house at that stage, yeah. Greg. But fair play to Dotsie Doherty there. He did try to pull me out at the last minute, but
yeah.
I know it was getting too messy at that stage, you know. Probably wouldn't have let us on anyway once even the seniors coming back.
Yeah. Oh, it's a salutary tale and a cautionary tale, John. I'm really sorry you had that. That experience, and hopefully at some point you'll get to go to a match, and you get to bring him to a match again in the future. But I know certainly you can ill afford to be losing that amount of money and the disappointment and tears, it's going to be real.
At that stage, Donald wasn't about the money; it was about the disappointment of the kids not getting in. You know, that was the big thing at that stage. They were looking forward to it so much. But as I said, it wasn't the holiday. Thankfully, wasn't. Put or organised around just go up to match. That was kind of an afterthought, but it was a nice surprise for them, and they were looking forward to it, you know. So, listen, naive, and we'll learn for the next time. Mm. Hopefully, we'll not be caught out again.
Yeah, John. Listen, thanks indeed for the call. We wish you well. Hope that it was a good holiday. This disappointment, notwithstanding, and have a safe journey home from Belfast.
Thanks, John. Catch you later.
Okay, bye-bye. John. You take care. Thank you. That's John there speaking to us from Belfast. And I suppose you have to be so careful. And I can understand that security in somewhere like St Mary's, a football ground like that, they do have to be careful. And I suppose they're going to have to adopt a policy that says you take no risks whatsoever. And sadly, John and his families were victims of that policy. I want to introduce you to a book that's just been published. If you're watching online, you can possibly see it in my hand. It's called How to Buy a Home in Ireland from the creator of Crazy House Prices. That's Crazy House Prices, the book, by the way, not the creator of Crazy House Prices. It took a whole economic situation to create that. But Ciarán Mulqueen is the author, and Ciarán joins us on Zoom. Ciarán, a very good morning to you.
Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure, Ciarán. And I suppose now more than ever, this book is important because people are going to be looking at the property market. They're going to be asking, should I buy? Can I afford to buy? Even if I can get a mortgage, you know, is this the right time to be buying? This book is going to help them to navigate that minefield.
Yeah, I guess that the whole idea of the book was kind of putting 3 years of conversations and learning and all that into a really kind of handy guide that people can refer back to no matter what stage they're at, whether that's, you know, before they've even started saving or maybe they're in currently bidding on houses or whatever. So it kind of just gives you a step-by-step guide as to what to do. Now, in terms of if now is the right time to buy or not, I don't have a crystal ball for that, but yep. With the way interest rates are at the moment and increasing lack of supply, if I would find something that I could afford and that I love and I plan on staying in for 10, 15 years, I'd be just going for it. I wouldn't be trying to speculate on a drop in prices or anything.
Now, my wife and I, we have two young adult children who live with us at the moment, and both are sort of talking about at some point aspiring to owning a house, but not quite yet. And we were talking interest rates around the tea table one night, and their eyebrows were raised when I told them that when we started initially looking at buying a house in late 1990, early 1991, interest rates were 14%. And when we bought in 1993, interest rates were about 8.5%. So it's a very, it was a very different situation back then. Now, that said, the prices weren't as crazy as they are now. And as the creator of these Crazy House Prices social media account, you know all about how the prices have gone.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there was interest rate relief back then as well. And
there was, you know, yes.
14% on 30,000 is a lot better than 4% on 400,000. So well, unfortunately, we're at the wrong end of it nowadays. But yeah, I can't see them going down anytime soon. But that's, I know experts are better people to listen to on that than I. I guess the book is more just about, you know, actually guiding you through what you need to do, the research, all that. There's some really good chapters in there, especially the research one gives you a lot of free websites you can use that can give you so much information about whatever home you're looking at.
In terms of the rent versus mortgage argument, are we getting to the point where it's actually, you so often hear rent is dead money, you should have a mortgage, because at least with a mortgage after whatever it is, 25, 30, 30 plus years even in some cases, you'll actually have a house to show for it. Are we getting to the point now where rents are so high that a mortgage actually does make more financial sense if you can afford, obviously, the deposit and if you can afford to enter the market?
Absolutely, yeah. I remember years ago I was renting a 3-bed on a corner site in a really good spot in Dublin, and it was $1,050 a month. I think that same home now would be probably around $4,000 a month. So it's a no-brainer, I think, really, for people if they can find somewhere that and get a mortgage. That's the hard part, you know. And often paying the mortgage is the easy part compared to paying 3 or 4 times that in rent.
I mean, for people who are considering buying at some point in the future, I suppose the advice is save, 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 try and get as much as you can together for that deposit, for your furniture, for whatever you're going to need to actually move into a house, because it's not just enough to get a mortgage. Obviously, once you've got a mortgage, even if you get a mortgage approved, you're going to have found the deposit, and you're going to face an awful lot of charges, be it in terms of stamp duty, be it in terms of solicitor's fees. There's an awful lot of, we won't say hidden costs, because you know they're there, but you know you don't necessarily think about them when you're in the initial planning stages, and people suddenly find, oh, I need $1,000 for this, I need $2,000 for that, and suddenly they find, oh sugar, I am $5,000 short.
Absolutely. I have a whole chapter in the book called Extra Costs. So as you said, they're not hidden costs, they're just extra costs. So everybody needs 10% deposit minimum. So I always tell people to aim for around about 12 or 13%, and that will give you enough then to cover solicitor's fees, your surveyors, even moving fees if you have to do that. So there's a whole chapter on that there where I kind of run through the average costs for each bit, like your surveyors and your mortgage protection, your home insurance, alarms, all that kind of stuff.
Obviously in Donegal and in some other counties, Mayo in particular, but Sligo and other counties across the country as well, we have that added complication now of defective blocks and deleterious materials. And there's the whole question mark, even if there is a very good looking house or apartment or whatever on the market in Donegal, there's going to be an element of caveat emptor there, because the question is going to be, you know, where do the blocks come from? Are the blocks compromised? Are there going to be issues with that house or that apartment down the line? So from that point of view, an awful lot of research, an awful lot of very careful consideration necessary, because ultimately, I suppose, the key phrase there is going to be caveat emptor, buyer beware.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's something I've posted about on my page a lot before. I get a lot of messages from people up in Donegal and as you said, in Sligo and Mayo and places that are impacted by those defects. And it's just a disgrace what they're being put through. And then especially as well for potential home buyers who are looking around, you might see something that looks like really good value, and then all of a sudden you start, you know, the alarm bells start ringing. So yeah, as you mentioned there, you just need to do your research. And I think maybe local knowledge as well would be really helpful on that, if you can kind of figure out who, if you know anyone around there. Or local knowledge tends to be quite good when it comes to where the blocks came from and things like that. It's probably not something you'll find on an open forum online.
Would the advice be to people, look, if there isn't a engineer's report available that you're satisfied with, to, if they're serious about the house, to commission their own engineer's report, bearing in mind that in itself is potentially going to cost 4 figures.
Yeah, absolutely. And in my opinion, before a home should be allowed, even be advertised for sale, all of that should be done by the vendor, by the seller, whether it's probate, whether it's engineer's reports. I think that's a change that could be made to the system here in Ireland when it comes to buying a home, is that the home should be legally ready to hand over the next day, in my opinion. It would save a whole lot of hassle, a whole lot of stress and a whole lot of money with people getting surveys done and then the sale falling through and then the next party come to buy it and they're getting the same survey done and that falls. Do you know, it's just, there are just so many things that could be fixed with the whole process here, to be honest. So I think they should be legally ready to hand over before they're even allowed to be advertised for sale. But unfortunately, we're not at that stage.
So potential changes in the law should be considered then at government level, because really what you're saying there, it would suggest that, I mean, and it's one thing to say what should be done and maybe what morally should be done and what's the ethical and right thing to do. But the real question is, you know, what's the legal thing to do? And that may actually require legislation in Dáil Éireann. And is there any hint you're getting from your posters and your sources that that's an area that Dara O'Brien is thinking about even?
No, I think they've so many other fires to try and put out at the moment. The speeding up the process is probably not on their radar. And I've spoken to Dara a good few times, and it is something I bring up. I have a whole chapter on changes that I think could improve the whole setup. And it's not like, you know, they're not original ideas. Some of them are, but most of them aren't original ideas for me. You know, it's just borrowed from other countries where you can't. So if you go sale agreed, you can't pull out without a valid reason. Whereas here, sale agreed is essentially just a handshake and you're not guaranteed anything. So there are some changes I think we could borrow from other countries. There are some other ideas I have in there as well. But fortunately, no, I don't see things changing anytime soon.
And that's something I presume you have to warn people of as well, because very often you'll hear people say, oh yeah, we have the house bought, we're planning to move in May, and then they make arrangements to move in May and then suddenly find, oh, the sellers have a problem with their new place, or they have a problem getting a mortgage for the new place, or something has happened and they now need to stay there until August, and suddenly you may have found yourself giving notice to quit your rental property in May because you anticipated moving into a new house, and then that's all fallen through. And, you know, we've all heard so many stories along those lines of deals that were, oh, absolutely, we'll be in by May, and they're lucky to be in by Christmas.
Absolutely. And there's I would always say to people, don't do anything until you've signed contracts, because until then anything can happen, really. Like, there was a story I posted a couple of weeks ago about an estate in Ballinrobe in Mayo, and there were eight families that had gone sale agreed and were ready to sign contracts on homes the next day, and a lot of them had given notice when that were in rentals, had given notice to leave because they were due to sign contracts the next day. And then all of a sudden the developer has sold all of the homes in the estate to a single buyer. So an investor or the state, we don't know yet. But for those people, that's, you know, that's an absolute disaster. That's your worst nightmare, really, when it comes to anything about buying a home, because they're essentially homeless now with nowhere to go unless they can rely on family. And they could be looking another year, year and a half to try and find something else. So it's just, there are just so many things that I think could be fixed and are easy fixes that would kind of solve a lot of these problems.
In terms of preparing for the mortgage application, and I suppose the first thing anyone's going to have to do when they're considering buying a home, the first thing you're going to have to do is try and make sure you have the money. One of the things we're told now is that if you put in a mortgage application, you know, your bank account's going to be forensically examined. And I've even heard suggestions, someone saying, look, don't ever join an online betting company or something, or don't do bets online, or don't bet on the Grand National online, because if there's transactions like that on your bank account, a potential mortgage vendor is going to look at that and question you about it. Is that actually the case?
Yeah, the betting thing is, you know, I personally wouldn't be going near any gambling websites if I was within 6 months to a year of looking to get a mortgage. If you're interested in that kind of thing, take out cash and do it in the shop. Don't do it on a card, and don't do it online. That would be my advice. And banks aren't overly strict. You know, they want you to be able to live your own life, and your accounts don't need to be, you know, living just off rice and vegetables, but you need to be able to show that you can support your current lifestyle. But the gambling thing, I would say, is a no-no. I guess the way a lender looks at it is, if they're willing to gamble with their own money, they'll definitely be willing to gamble with ours. So yeah. It wouldn't be something I would advise anyway. Definitely not within 6 months to a year out.
So as you say, you know, the advice to people would be, look, whatever you think the guide price is going to be on the house, if you're anticipating spending, we'll say for the sake of argument, 200,000. Now, in Donegal, you'll get a reasonably good house for 200,000 euro. Sorry for those who may be listening in Dublin, but that's the reality. I mean, yeah. You know, so if so, and we'll just take 200,000 as a reasonable price for a three-bedroom semi in, say, a town like Letterkenny or Ballybuffet, Buncrana or whatever. So you'd be advising people, you know, try to make sure you have 12-13%, which effectively you're talking, look, try to have maybe 24-25 grand in savings, which is no mean achievement, which is no mean feat in itself. And I mean, you know, it's going to be difficult getting 25 grand together, let's be honest, even to have that as your deposit and your money for those extra costs. Once that's done, in terms of shopping around in the mortgage market, I mean, are there deals there? Or because you hear so often, oh, everyone follows everyone else and one mortgage is pretty much the same as another, and much as some financial institutions will you know, advertise that they're so different to everybody else. Are there deals out there, or is one mortgage vendor much the same as another in terms of the rates, in terms of the T's and C's?
They're all increasing their rates at different times, and some will have better rates than others. Some might be easier to deal with than others. My advice especially if somebody's a first-time buyer, would just be go to a broker. I think the brokers are really handy because they're usually free. You know, they usually get their fee from the bank or the lender, and they will kind of know the market a lot better than you will or than I would, because the market is always changing and rates are always changing. So I would always advise people to go to a broker. Use somebody that comes recommended, that's from somebody you know has used themselves, and when you're talking to the broker, ask them, you know, what their terms are. Some will charge a fee, most don't, and they will tend to know which lender will suit your application best. And the lowest rate isn't always the best one. Sometimes some rates are a little bit higher, but you know they might give you cash back that makes it more worthwhile, or sometimes the rate is lower and they give you cash back, but it's not worthwhile in the long run. So you need to do your figures on that. And that's, I think, where a broker comes in. And it's just something I'd recommend, especially if it's your first time getting a mortgage. But you can do some comparisons yourself on ccpc.ie. And I have a whole chapter on that in the book as well, in terms of whether to go direct to the lender or whether to use a broker, and where you can go to do price comparisons or interest rate comparisons and all that.
The other question then becomes, do you go fixed rate or do you go variable rate? And I suppose that's going to change depending on what deals are on the cards. Again, the broker perhaps the best person to get advice on that, or would you suggest even going to a financial advisor on that?
Yeah, anybody who is a kind of qualified financial advisor would be best to talk about whether you go fixed or variable. It's kind of beyond my abilities. But yeah, definitely get professional advice. A broker will help with that as well. Or if you wanted to go a step further, you could definitely talk to a qualified financial advisor.
Kieran Mulqueen is the author. The book is How to Buy a Home in Ireland. And it is one which... you know, anyone who is considering buying would do an awful lot worse than actually picking up a copy of this and making their first act to sit down, have a good read, and just get their own head together. Kieran, pleasure talking to you. Thanks indeed.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Appreciate that. Thank you indeed, Kieran. That's Kieran there. And the book, as we say, How to Buy a Home in Ireland. It's published by Cathaoirleog, it's a Hatchet Books, and it's, as they say, available in all good bookshops. If you want to make contact, you can text us on 086 60 25000. That number is good for WhatsApp messages as well. You can also call us, of course, 074 91 25000, 00353 74 91 25000. If you're outside of the dialing area, we have Niamh and Caroline taking your calls this morning. Just some of your comments that have been coming through. Caller says, in relation to bullying, I feel as though there should be a volunteer always at hand in the school, not a teacher as such, but perhaps a local volunteer to help educate and advise children on the dangers of bullying. I've witnessed firsthand this bullying leading into workplace and adult life. It needs to stop now and sooner rather than later, so says a quarter. So sorry to hear, another quarter says, that this girl is suffering at the hands of others in school or class. Some schools don't want to hear of bullying, but there's a responsibility that rests with the school teachers and the board. Time is of the essence here. Imagine this was your child bravely enduring unacceptability. They have a duty of care. Please help settle this soon. And a nice message, thanks to Martina and Davy from the Tavern Bar in Kilcluny, Portneau, for the box of toys they left at the seafront in Narn for children to use at the beach. That's from the local Tidy Towns Committee. Now, let's talk road safety. The Road Safety Authority have received 180 complaints every month about driving tests. 2,205 complaints in 12 months, when a particularly high number were lodged in August, 297. One driver claimed they were the victim of partial and very racist treatment by a tester, claiming they'd been prejudged because of their ethnicity. Shane O'Donoghue is the editor of CompleteCar.ie. Shane, good morning.
Good morning, Donald.
Shane, how big a problem is it that we have up to 180 complaints a month about driving tests on average each year? Does that point to a problem?
I think it's worth investigating, but when you look into the detail from the RSA, I mean, it is worth pointing out that that is just over 1% of the total number of people tested. And I'd also assume that they only get complaints from people who have failed their tests. So, you know, most of those presumably are justifiable fails, and people will be disgruntled, will be disappointed, and that breeds a situation where people are going to feel the need to complain. Now, I'm not saying that the complaints that we're talking about aren't justified in any way, but I think they need to be taken in context in that way, I guess. I suspect that most of those complaints, or almost none of those complaints, are from people that have passed the test. The RSA does say that it investigates each and every one of them before it replies to the complainant. So it's not that it's ignoring the problem. You know, it has actually released these figures.
Obviously, the complaint about alleged racism is a very serious one, and one would certainly hope that complaint would be taken seriously. That does appear to be the exception rather than the rule, though. There's no suggestion that that is an ingrained problem as such.
No, I agree with you on that. It does appear to be an isolated case, and you would really hope that there are no widespread issues with that in our country in 2023. Also, I mean, we don't have full details of that complaint. The words used were that the person felt like they were prejudged, and it just, you know, we can't get to the bottom of that without a lot more information. You know, what information or what evidence is there for that? What actually happened to the person that makes them say that? I mean, if it is the case, it is very serious, and hopefully RSA is looking into it. But most, as you say, most of the complaints are to do with people feeling like they failed unfairly. They failed the test unfairly. So to the car they've turned up in, or that mistakes they've made themselves. And those make interesting reading.
Yeah. I mean, I failed my first test and passed my second. Personally, I actually felt I drove better on the first test than I drove on the second. I felt I drove better on the one I failed than I drove on the one I passed. In fact, I was convinced I was going to fail the second, and then I was given the pass. So, I mean, sometimes our perception as the testee can be different to the perception of the tester. And I suppose what we have to do in that case is say, look, he or she is the professional. They know what they're doing.
That's right. I mean, I know that there is still a human element in it in terms of the testers, and there'll be some variability. They are given clear guidelines. And actually, anybody who's going for a test, well worth their while searching online for the guidelines that the testers receive, because there's a PDF document you can download, and that shows the guidance that the RSA gives to testers and how to mark tests, how to assess people being tested. And it's really interesting reading because it'll help people prepare even better for it. But regardless of that, regardless of how scientific the RSA tries to make the whole process, there's no doubt that there's some human variability in there. And, you know, one tester might let something small go, another might pick up on it, etc. So it's not as black and white as it would ideally be, I guess.
We're told one driver said they'd been marked down because they were being too cautious on the road. Now, I can sort of understand that because, you know, if someone isn't driving with confidence, they can be potentially holding up other traffic and, you know, creating problems in doing that. So I suppose you can be too cautious as well as being too reckless.
Well, 100%. There is no law about driving too slow, but there is guidance on that in terms of if you're causing an obstruction from your overcautious driving, then you know you could be penalised for undue care and attention. Now, specifically with regards to the driving test, I had a look at the manual for the testers, and there is a section on the driver maintaining decent progress. Now, there's no more measured than that. It's not scientific as such, but if the tester feels that the driver is so nervous or so cautious that they're not making normal progress, they're really slow, they're, you know, stopping short of the line at traffic lights, they're not going when the light is green, these kind of things, that they can actually be marked down for it. But it's worth pointing out that, you know, one incident of that is unlikely to fail the test. There's a lot more to it than that. And if you're not being dangerous, you're unlikely to fail a test just for instance, not making enough progress a couple of times. There's a lot more to it.
How much of this is down to ourselves as drivers that when we go into a test, and it's, I'll be honest, it's a long time since I did my test, but when we're going into a test, sometimes, and I felt, certainly for the first test, I was thinking in terms of, first I will have to do a 3-point turn, then I will have to do a hill start. And I was actually thinking about the things I would have to do rather than thinking about the thing I was doing, which was driving. And it's almost as though I started and I was driving along the road, but in my head I was just driving in order to do the things I had to do. And is there a risk that we put too much emphasis on the things and not enough emphasis on the driving to the things, if that makes sense?
No, I understand what you mean. Look, it's a nerve-wracking experience for everybody who goes and does the driving test, no matter how confident they are, no matter how much practice they've put in. It is nerve-wracking because it's one moment. You've probably waited months to get the test, which is an issue still. And, you know, it's an €85 fee. So you really do want to pass it in that one moment. And I don't think it's a great system at all. I know it's been improved in recent years. We have the essential driver training where all learners now have to go through a certain number of driving lessons, which are specific themes. And that's a big improvement. But I think we need a lot more than that. I think we need, off-road, as in not on the public road, facilities where people are trained in the very basics and until they're, you know, completely proficient at it. And they don't have to go to a driving test with their nerves in shreds wondering if they can do a 3-point turn. They should have done it hundreds of times already before. And likewise, then that would free up their brain, if you like, for thinking about the important things like driving safely on the road, like you just alluded to.
In terms of one of the other, of course, changes we've seen in more recent years is the introduction of the N plate, where after passing a test for 2 years, the L plates come off, but the N plates go on. Now, it is long before N plates that I passed mine. But has that system worked in terms of saying to people, look, yeah, you've passed your test, but you've now got 2 years to hone your skills? And we're just going to say to people, yeah, they've passed their test, but, you know, give them a bit of leeway because they're still learning.
I'm not sure. I don't personally feel that the N plate itself has any real function other than perhaps, you know, try to warn other users to give a bit more room perhaps to a new driver. I'm not convinced. I think again, probably following on from what I've just said, and I don't want to bang on about too much, is perhaps more training, more driver training, more practice. So follow on essential driver training, if you like. So
yeah.
Yes, you've passed your test. Well done. Now, in the next 2 years, you must also do these five modules somewhere where, you know, you get a bit more used to using the motorway. You get used to driving at night and hazard identification, these kind of things. Just slightly more advanced for somebody that is allowed out on the road on their own now as soon as they've got the driving license.
And the other thing that tends not to be part of the test and isn't covered in lessons as often perhaps is parallel parking and actually parking and things like that. Should maybe the system be expanded as such to bring those in? Because I'll be honest, I mean, I had a driver's license and I was awful at parking. It took me quite a while to actually even pluck up the courage to parallel park. And I would even say now I'm not great at it.
I must admit, I'm the same as you. I did my test a very long time ago, but when I did my parallel park, it was part of it. I don't know if it is still. Maybe it isn't. I'm not so sure. I think if we had a system where there was follow-on driver training, that would be great to put into. But really, I think in the initial instance, we need to be training drivers to be safe. We need them to be, you know, watching the road properly, know what they're doing from behind the wheel, and not to be nervous and worrying about manoeuvres. I mean, so what if you can't parallel park perfectly? Like, I think there are people who've been driving for decades who still can't parallel park. And every parking space is different.
Yeah.
You know, it's not really that scientific. So I feel that actually focusing on such things for the driving test day itself is counter, it's not helpful really at all.
The other thing that's changing an awful lot, and in fairness, we're actually going off the brief slightly of the interview, which was about complaints about drivers' experiences. But the other thing that seems to be coming in more and more now is people going for automatic-only licences and doing tests in automatics, only for automatics, because the thought would be, given that policy is that there'll be no more petrol or diesel cars sold by 2030, and all hybrids and electrics are automatic, I mean, the presumption would appear to be that we'd all be driving automatics within a very short number of years.
That's right. Somebody told me, a friend of mine told me that their kid was doing their driving test and doing it in an automatic only, and I was gobsmacked. I couldn't believe it. It felt such a strange thing to do, to mm-hmm. limit yourself to. But in the future, you're absolutely right. I mean, all electric cars are automatic, etc. But I feel people are limiting themselves right now because, you know, in 2030, all manual cars, petrol and diesel cars, they aren't just being scrapped and thrown in a bin. They're still going to be around for quite some time. And it also means that somebody who's passed their test on an automatic license could never drive a Catholic car with a manual gearbox, for instance. So I think it's very limiting. Yes, of course, it's easier to drive an automatic car, much easier to drive an automatic car. It is a whole new skill to learn to control a clutch and gears, etc. And perhaps that doesn't help the learner. But I don't know. I would urge learners to make the effort, to be honest.
Yeah. Shane O'Donoghue, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. 180 complaints every month, we're told, as we said, about driving tests. It's a story we'll be looking at, and hopefully the sort of analysis that you say is necessary will take place sooner rather than later. Shane, for the moment, thanks very much indeed.
Thanks, Donal.
Thank you, Shane. That's Shane there, the editor of CompleteCar.ie. It is 16 minutes to 12 midday, 16 minutes left before I take my leave and hand you over to John Breslin, who'll be around the northwest for 2.5 hours until 2:30. Now, I am delighted to say I am joined in the studio by a world champion. And if you're looking on our YouTube or Facebook page, you will see a huge trophy with a really good-looking globe on it, smack in the middle of the picture. We're joined, I'm delighted to say, by Emily from Dunloe. Emily, good morning.
Hello, how are you? Good morning.
Very well indeed. Emily Colangelo, the world under-19 Irish dancing champion, just back from Montreal in the past day.
Yeah, I mean, I'm absolutely wrecked, but, you know, it's been absolutely amazing. And, like, the amount of people that I've just been, like, messaging, and it's just been amazing. And, you know, I came home from Donegal Airport and the dancing school were there, and I'm so, so grateful. Like, there was banners and posters and everything made, and, you know, it was just so overwhelming, but it's been absolutely amazing, the support I've had, so I'm really grateful.
This isn't a one-off. This is your third trophy.
Yeah, this is my third one, and I'm going to be retiring now competitively. I have my Leaving Cert coming up, so that's going to be the main focus. So I'll be back to the books now straight away after this, and then I'm just going to take a break, and I'm going to go on to do the professional shows then. So it's a lot of things to look forward to.
And that's in the family, because, I mean, your brother Tomás, 4 Ulster titles. Only Ulster titles, and I'm sure I'm sure you remind him of that from time to time. But he's pro at the moment, isn't he?
Yeah, he's absolutely amazing. He's actually watching as well. He's on tour with Celtic Legends at the moment in France. So I want to say a big hello to Thomas and Mitch, who's watching all the way from France on the tour of Celtic Legends, because, you know, that's absolutely amazing. And Thomas has been supporting and watching me all through the Worlds in Montreal, and so is the whole cast. So I got loads of videos when I won of them all screaming.
Excellent. Can you just pull the trophy a little closer to yourself? Because what we have now is we can see the trophy, but we can't see your face.
Yep.
And, you know, I don't want to. So, actually, if you put it over closer to where those headphones are and just push it over a bit more. Yeah, perfect. That's lovely. Because we were obscuring your face, which is where it was. You know, no, it's lovely to have it in the centre of the shop. We want to be able to see you as well. You're with the McNeilis Cunningham School of Irish Dancing, Emily, and I presume you've been at this since you were in the height of a grasshopper.
Yeah, I started dancing when I was 3.5. So I've been dancing for like 15 years now. So it's been amazing. And, you know, I'm in like literally a school of like absolute ladies. My teachers are so, so nice and they're so supportive. And, you know, I'm so grateful to them for all their help over the years, because it takes a team for something like this to happen, and like the support of them and the help and the encouragement, you know, I really wouldn't be here.
Well, this surely must be more than going to Irish dancing lessons, being dragged to a kicking and screaming one day a week. I mean, you've obviously been putting in the hard yards. They say perfection takes 10,000 hours of practice. To achieve what you've been achieving, you've done 10,000 hours and more. This wasn't just once a week for half an hour.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's intense training that goes into it, and, you know, we really do train like Olympians. And I do actually cross train as well. So I have a personal trainer called Anne-Marie. She's from Dunlow, and I train with her twice a week. And then on top of that, I do my dancing practice as well. So, you know, it does take a lot of work for something like this to happen, and you have to have the strength behind it as well. So, you know, Anne-Marie's been amazing too, and she's really helped me over the years. So I'm really grateful to her too.
And it is physically demanding. I mean, you know, this is, I mean, I don't want to say it's a competitive sport, but in a way it is. I mean, you are pushing yourself and pushing yourself to the limit.
Yeah, you really are. And like, it does take blood, sweat and tears. But, you know, if you really work hard, listen to your teachers, and you have the right family and the right, you know, encouragement behind you and support, you know, something like this can happen, you know. I'm just so grateful.
I presume there's an international network, and that when you were competing in Montreal, you would have known an awful lot of the girls you were competing against, because you've probably been competing against each other since you were 11 or 12. I follow Formula One, and there's great pictures of, you see videos of Max Verstappen and Charles Leclerc having an argument when they're both 10 in go-karts, and they've kept it right through up to Formula One. I'm sure it's the same in you, that you competed against girls in Montreal that you probably first came across when you were 10, 11, 12.
Oh, the friends and the memories you make dancing is just incredible. Like, I have one of the best memories, you know, of Irish dancing has been like most like the worlds and all these international competitions, because you have like Americans, you've got like people from all over the world coming, and like, you just, it's just amazing meeting up with them and, you know, sharing your love for dance, because everyone has that in common. And, you know, it's just amazing. You know, I've met some absolutely amazing people dancing, and I'm so grateful.
Were the Worlds in Belfast this time last year?
Yes, they were.
And the reason I can say that, actually, is, as it happens, it was a year ago tonight, I was at a concert in the Ulster Hall.
Oh.
So I stayed in what it was then Jury's Hotel. I think it's now called the Leonardo Hotel. I think it's actually been changed. But there was a major dance championship on that week.
Yeah.
I think my daughter and I think were the only two non-Irish dancing people staying in that hotel. And that hotel, I can tell you, was fairly mad.
Yeah, I mean, like, the night after the Worlds, like, we've had all such amazing memories, you know, like with going to some pools and, you know, dancing. Like, this was in Montreal, we had the Hills of Donegal playing, and we were off dancing like in the middle of Montreal, like, and I think the bar staff were ready to kill us.
You're 19.
Yes, I am.
Talk to me about the discipline, because you're not going to the pub with your mates on a Friday night.
No.
Not regularly. You're certainly not going to the disco. You're not coming into Letterkenny or going in wherever to go to the discos and hit the tiles and coming home at 3 o'clock in the morning with a couple of WKDs or whatever.
No.
You know, you have got to be really, really careful. And you have had to make a choice, I suspect, from a very early age that I am not going to go down that road.
Yeah, I know. Like, I mean, the discipline that you have to have with dancing, like, it's incredible. You know, I've had numerous times I've seen my friends out partying and having the best time of their lives, and I've been at home because I'm in bed early, I've danced in the next morning. And I think that's kind of where, like, you know, after the Worlds, you kind of get to have that, you know, time that you get to celebrate, and it makes it even more special. But yeah, you know, you have to give up so many things with dancing, and that's a sacrifice you have to make. But, you know, that's where you get something like this then. And you know, there's numerous nights that I've kind of given up, and I've been really, really annoyed and been like, oh, I really wanted to go out that night. But it's been so worth it when things like this happen, because you have to have your sleep, and you have to have your discipline. And, you know, with school especially too, you know, you have to just just for this next few months, you have to stay on track and not be going out mad the weekend.
Talk to me about the commitment and the family financial commitment when it gets into Irish dancing. I mean, you hear some prices for the dresses that would boggle the mind.
Yeah.
Even things like the wigs. Now, and I would be honest, I'm not a huge fan of the wigs. I actually,
they're quite sore.
I can imagine. And I'll be honest, I am looking at you, and I will say it up front. I mean, you know, you are a very well presented and good looking young person who
Thank
does
you.
Not need a wig to make herself look in anyway. You know, so from that point of view, the actual money that goes into the dresses and to the wigs and to everything else, it must be a huge financial commitment for a family starting off. And once you're getting into the worlds, I'm sure the actual costs of the dresses and the wigs and the shoes and everything that goes with it at the worlds is going to rise exponentially because you have got to go there with the absolute best, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. Like, you know, there's a lot of things that do go into it, and there's a lot of things, you know, your family has to sacrifice in order to make something like this happen. And that's why I say I'm grateful to so many people, and my family and teachers especially, because, you know, they all came over and they all supported me and, you know, went to the worlds and stuff. And I just think it's absolutely amazing, and I'm so grateful to them because I know it's such a hard thing to do as well, to give up. But, you know, we have one of these now, and I'm just so happy.
As you said, Tomás is dancing with the Celtic Legends Tour in France at the moment. Have you had offers in terms, as you say, first and foremost, leaving cert is on the cards.
Yes.
So it's dive into the books now between now and June.
Yeah.
Once June is finished, I mean, do you have offers on the table?
Yeah.
Presumably, I mean, everyone in the professional shows knows who you are. They all know you have that in front of you.
Yeah.
And, you know, who needs a CV when you have that trophy, you know?
You know, the absolute dream would be Riverdance, because I just love that show so much. But yes, I just have to get the leaving cert out of the way first.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want to have a wee break, you know, just to kind of transition between, you know, the show dance and the professional dancing, I think, then come maybe September. So I'll start with the show dancing and start a new chapter of my life.
Yeah. Is Riverdance touring at the moment?
They are. I think they just finished their European tour,
yeah,
and they're still doing their American tour. So, I mean, it would just be the dream to do something like that, you know.
But there's no doubt once it becomes known that Emily is awaiting offers, those offers presumably. I mean, do you get an agent? How does this work?
No.
Would they contact you? I mean, I'm sure there is a network within Irish dancing where you know people who know people who know. You're probably one, if at most, two steps away from Riverdance. You know someone who knows someone who knows the booking agent, if you don't know the booking agent directly at this stage.
You know, just like show dancing is so much different than competitive dancing, and like, it doesn't really matter who you are with, you know, show dancing. You know, you just kind of, it's all about, you know, like how you present yourself on stage with show dancing, and you're using your arms as well, which is a thing that we don't use in competitive dancing. So that's, you know, some people can do that and some people can't. So, you know, it's just up to the person, really. And, you know, I have applied for a few shows, so I have, but I'm just kind of waiting until after leaving cert, and then once I get that out of the road, then I can just...
And in a sense, you've anticipated what my final question is going to be. How regimented are the routines you do for the competitions now? Can you put your own personality into them? Can you come up with your own moves, or are you doing what your teachers lay out, or do they give you a basic structure and you add to it, or is it a communication between the two?
So there's, like, with my dance, when we're choreographing or we're making up steps, you know, I have my one dance teacher, Paula, and she always makes up the steps for me, and I think it takes a few goes before we kind of get the final one. But my set of dancing's like very kind of, my leg comes out a lot, and you know, I kind of throw some stuff in sometimes, and I'll show Paula and she'll be like, nope, don't like it or whatever. And then we'll try and think of something new. But it does, that's what I mean. It takes a team for something like that to happen. And, you know, we work with each other, and all the different dance teachers, you know, add something into the dancing themselves and the routines. So, like, that's what I mean. I'm so grateful to have all of their expertise, because each one of them has, you know, something different to say. So it's brilliant.
And once you get into show dancing, you will have a choreographer who will show you.
Oh,
and
you
tell
just
you
learn the
exactly
stuff they
what
have
to do, and you do it when they say to do it. Emily, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you.
Thanks so much
thank
for having me.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thank
you. It's been a pleasure, and we wish you all the best with the career. But most importantly, right now, we wish you all the best with the leaving.
I think I'll need that too. Thank you.
Well done. Congratulations. An amazing achievement. Now, before we go, I want to go to line one because I know Eddie was on line one. Eddie, are you still there?
Oh, I'm still here, yeah.
Eddie, thank you so much for waiting. Eddie, I'm sorry, I ran over there. You were at the Etihad Stadium, which is Man City Stadium, a few weeks back, and you were checked for jerseys as well.
Yeah, so luckily I do have an air of sympathy for John there and what happened to him at St Mary's at Southampton, but I went over for the Man City-Aston Villa game. Well, it was simple enough. What happened was we were walking up and obviously we were asked for the tickets, and then it was a cold enough day, so I was well wrapped up, but I had the City jersey on, and obviously they had a quick look to make sure I had a City jersey on before I went into the home side of the ground. And then I noticed there was a little incident at a place called, Mary D's, whereby a Man City fan and an Aston Villa fan, they were obviously friends. They were walking up together, and the Villa guy was stopped from getting in because he was wearing an Aston Villa top.
And I suppose it, and that's a sad thing to hear, because, you know, I'm sure there are friendships between various people who support various clubs, and, you know, they're going to have to be very circumspect about where they go after the game. I mean, I was at a game once, and I was in the away supporters' end because I was with my brother, who was, now it was an Aston Villa Chelsea game at Villa Park. My brother is a Chelsea supporter. I don't have a team. The closest I have to a team is Leighton Orient, because I lived in Leighton when I was in London. But you know, we were there, and there was no way we would have had any contact with anyone who was in the Villa home end. I mean, we were pretty much escorted from the stadium to the bus to the train station. It was really interesting the way it was done. Eddie, listen, thanks very much indeed. Thank you for waiting, and thanks for the comment there. That's the end of the show. Thank you so much to all our participants. Thanks to you for listening.